Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Gustav has come and gone, but in alphabetical order out in the Atlantic, we've still got Hannah, Ike, and Josephine on the way. Gulf Coast residents are beginning to head home, but with all those storms still lined up, what do you suppose is the cost of getting out of the way? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, September 2nd. Good to have you with us. City officials in New Orleans say it's going to be another day or two before they're really ready to have evacuees come home. It's much the same story all along the Gulf Coast, because not too many people in Gustav's path were taking any chances. Nearly 2 million people headed north. But a delayed return is a problem they're happy to have, given the alternative. Even though the storm wasn't as severe as expected, it still left billions in property damage behind it. But a bigger cost to businesses might turn out to be living with those frequent mass evacuations. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Hurricane Gustav turned New Orleans into a ghost town. In a city of 300,000 people, an estimated 10,000 remained. Doug Woodward at the University of South Carolina says economists have a name for that.
Yes, we call it shock, an economic shock. Subject to shocks, people change their behavior, and it takes a certain amount of time before it gets back to normal.
Woodward says if mass evacuations were to become the norm, businesses would think twice about locating in the southeast.
To realize that every year, even if the big one doesn't occur, you still might have to evacuate, and certainly doesn't help our competitive advantage.
Most insurance policies don't cover losses due to an evacuation. Robert Hartwig with the Insurance Information Institute says companies are forced to adapt.
In many cases, the business has just shifted forward to another point in time. If you're a hotel or a restaurant, the convention might be rescheduled for a few weeks later.
Small businesses are particularly vulnerable to evacuations. Yi Deng is a computer science professor at Florida International University.
A critical thing missing is reliable, real-time information, such as where are my employees, where are my supplies, what's the status of my customers?
One study found 40% of companies that stay closed for 3 days after a storm were out of business within 3 years. The New Orleans evacuation is expected to last 4 days. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
We've got a better idea today of the damage that was done to the Gulf Coast's oil infrastructure. Not too much, it seems. Production is expected to be back up to 100% sooner rather than later, maybe a week or less. That helps explain why oil hit a five-month low at one point this afternoon. Airline stocks rose on that oil drop. The airplane maker Boeing did fine, considering. It's waiting for the results of a key contract vote by its biggest union tomorrow. Danielle Carson reports.
Boeing says the 300-page agreement is its final offer. Spokesman Tim Healy calls it the best contract in the industry.
It rewards employees for the success that the company has had. We've had 3 strong years selling airplanes. They've earned it, they deserve it, and that's what this offer does.
The contract would bump up wages 11% and pensions more than 14% over 3 years. Merrick Masters, an analyst at the University of Pittsburgh, says the contract is generous, but
these workers want a share of the record profits. They look at them having made a good deal of effort to make Boeing in the situation that it's in today, and they're asking for their fair share.
Analysts say a strike would hurt Boeing's delivery schedule of government contracts. A strike could also cost the company $100 million a day in revenue. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
In the music business, it's not always the songwriter that makes the money. Often it's the person or the company that owns the rights to that music, even if the music in question is kind of old. There are reports today that the iconic songs of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II may soon be on the auction block. Rodgers and Hammerstein were behind many of the big Broadway hits of the 1940s and 50s, and it seems their catalog could fetch a couple of $100 million. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes it from there.
When a revival of the musical South Pacific opened on Broadway this spring, it was an instant hit. It left theatergoers whistling Some Enchanted Evening and Bali High nearly 60 years after their debut. Leonard Jacobs is national theater editor of the trade newspaper Backstage.
Because it has become such a phenomenal hit, it just proves all over again how valuable the catalog is. Why R&H wouldn't want that revenue stream is sort of beyond me.
R&H is the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. The company makes money by licensing its music for use in everything from commercials to the stage. A spokesman had no comment on reports that the song catalog or even the whole company might be for sale. R&H is owned by two family trusts. The company is known for guarding the Rodgers and Hammerstein legacy. CEO Ted Chapin reportedly turned down many a South Pacific revival before okaying the current production. Broadway producer Roger Berlind says an outside buyer may be less cautious with the brand.
Someone from the outside might be able to exploit it to a greater extent than they are willing to, but they have to recognize the integrity of the catalog itself and the value of those assets and not denigrate them by over-promotion or having the material presented in a way that they wouldn't be proud of.
Still, Berlin says, so long as no one changes the notes or the lyrics, it shouldn't matter who owns the songs. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here's this week's sign the popular culture apocalypse is upon us.
The show that defined a generation, 90210.
The fall television season has started, and the CW network is bringing back West Beverly High and Shannon Daugherty as Brenda. The remake of a popular 1990s show, Beverly Hills 90210, debuts tonight. It's the latest try at getting young viewers to spend a little less time in front of YouTube and a little more time in front of that other tube. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
This season, it's all about 90210. Last year's hot show was Gossip Girl. Variety columnist Brian Lowry says the show made headlines, but
the ratings for Gossip Girl were mediocre. There were a lot of downloads of it online, but downloads are not the same as a big mass network TV audience.
It's going to be even tougher for the networks this season. The writer's strike shrunk the number of new shows. It also cut the pilot season, leaving a lot less time to build buzz. And there's last season to worry about. Peter Tortorici is CEO of media strategist firm Group M Entertainment.
So many shows had a very short window of opportunity to connect with viewers before the strike interrupted.
NBC was able to promote its new season during the Olympics. The Games brought in the biggest audience since the Friends finale. But the payoff may not last beyond season premieres. Roger Smith is with media research firm Global Media Intelligence. He says the needle on network viewing points south. There were 10% fewer viewers last year than there were the year before.
This is a demographic thing. Young people do not watch traditional television in anything like the numbers that their parents do.
Who needs a box when you can watch shows on your laptop or talk to your friends on Facebook? Smith expects network viewing will be down this year by 3%. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Today was one of those days you had to pay attention to Wall Street the whole time to really get the story. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. John McCain and the Republican Party are going to try to turn their convention back to politics tonight. That provides us the opportunity to do something similar to what we did when the Democrats were meeting in Denver last week. Ask some GOP policy types to weigh in on this topic. What can your party do better? Commentator Raihan Salam says some Republicans have lost touch with the economic anxiety of average Americans, and he offers a suggestion for self-improvement.
Republicans have been winning elections by promising income tax cuts for decades. But times have changed. When Ronald Reagan promised to slash taxes in 1980, a median income family of four was paying almost 12% of its earnings in federal income taxes. It's no wonder that the tax burden was the number one issue for middle-class families. Since then, however, that number has fallen to less than 6%, which is why the GOP seems so out of touch with the economic fears that keep Americans up at night. The working and middle-class voters who form the bedrock of the Republican base still worry about their income taxes, sure. But they worry a lot more about rising health insurance premiums and gas prices and the huge share of their income that goes to the regressive, job-killing payroll tax. This year, John McCain has offered voters a decent plan to tackle healthcare costs and a way forward on energy. But if he wants to win the election and build a lasting Republican majority, he needs to go further than Ronald Reagan ever dared. He needs to take on the payroll tax. In 2005, the payroll tax raised $760 billion. The income tax raised $1.1 trillion. The main difference is the income tax burden is borne by the rich, while the payroll tax hits working stiffs. That's why we need a fairer, more family-friendly system. Call it a progressive consumption tax with a twist. The rich would pay a higher rate than the poor, savings would be exempt, and now for the twist. The idea behind the payroll tax is that, through Social Security, you eventually get out of the system what you put in. But we all know that today's retirees are supported by today's workers, and tomorrow's retirees will be supported by today's children. So why not give parents of young children a big credit against the payroll tax, big enough so that a middle-class family with two or three kids will pay zip? The Democrats will cry foul, but moms and dads across the country will know that the Republicans are looking out for them and not just a bunch of hedge fund billionaires.
Raihan Salam is the co-author of the book Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Let us know what you think about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. By most measures, this was probably a pretty normal back-to-school day for kids around the country, the ones who are lucky enough to live in districts that don't start till after Labor Day anyway. But if you take the time to look real close, there is something different going on this year. A survey out from the American Association of School Administrators shows rising fuel costs are affecting virtually every district in the country. So some are cutting back to working 80% of the time, keeping classes in session longer, but only 4 days a week. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the first of two stories now on going back to school.
One of the states that's most on board with the four-day school week is Colorado, mainly because it's so rural, which means long bus routes.
As of 2007, we had 67 out of 178 districts that are on a four-day week.
That's Wendy Dunaway with the Colorado Department of Education. She says the districts that have switched are almost all rural and are generally happy with the change. On a rainy afternoon at a hotel in Colorado Springs, about 25 people gather in a medium-sized conference room. They're parents, teachers, and administrators from the Calhoun School District, which has been on a four-day schedule since the last energy crisis nearly three decades ago. Susan Vanass is the district's business manager.
Our school district covers about 200 square miles, so almost all of our kids are bused in.
So the buses are literally going 100 miles a day?
Easily. Most of our routes are between 70 and 80. We do have one that's 119 miles.
And these things don't get good gas mileage, I assume?
No. We're talking 7-8 miles a gallon.
Vanessa says the school saves tens of thousands of dollars a year in bus fuel alone. And schools on four-day weeks also save on heating and electricity. Jerry Monks is Calhoun's high school principal. He used to teach at a five-day school, and he says the four-day week also boosts student attendance.
It seems like kids more often make their appointments on Mondays and try to do their business on Mondays so that they're there Tuesday through Friday.
What do you think are the minuses of having a four-day week?
We could provide more in terms of depth of curriculum over a course of 5 days, and perhaps a little bit of just the discipline of rigor of going 5 days to work, 5 days to school.
That may be, but four-day proponents point out studies that show no negative impact in terms of student test scores. There's not a positive one either. There is the problem of tired kids who are in school for 8 hours instead of 6 or 7. On the street in Calhoun, people tell me they've gotten used to the shortened week. Residents say finding daycare isn't a problem. Young kids work on farms, or high school students on the same schedule babysit them. Ed Dovin runs the local auto repair shop. He says his daughter spends Mondays with the grandparents.
They teach her to sew and different things like that, so it's good for both of them.
And as for Bree Marshbanks, a Calhoun School graduate starting her second year of college?
I love the four-day school week. I miss it. In college, we have 5 day, and I hate it.
Did you feel like you were learning as much as your friends maybe who were in 5 day schools?
Yeah, I have the 3.9 at college, so.
Now, even the Calhoun School administrators caution a four-day week is not for everyone. And in fact, lots of schools couldn't switch if they wanted to because of state laws that mandate school time in days, not hours. But Daniel Dominich at the American Association of School Administrators says even if gas prices dip and the four-day trend fades, the underlying problem is here to stay.
I wish I could say that it's very unusual for school districts to have problems with budgets, but it isn't. It's always been a struggle and always will be.
In Calhoun, Colorado, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, needling the economics of acupuncture.
I have many people walking in the door in a state of panic, and we give them needles, and they walk out of the door saying, thank you so much, I feel so much better.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials were up 250 points today before closing down 0.2%, 26 points, 11,516 the number. The Nasdaq slipped 0.75%, 18 points, finished at 23.49. The S&P 500 sank 0.4%, 5 points, ended the day at 12.77. Falling oil prices pushed energy companies lower. Both Exxon and Chevron slid more than 3.3%. Commodities came under pressure, too. Aluminum producer Alcoa crumpled 5%. Airlines took off on that oil news, as I mentioned. American and United both soared more than 11% today. Financials sold like hotcakes. Freddie Mac powered up 14%. Fannie Mae jumped 8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 3.70%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. Major automakers release U.S. sales figures for August. The Fed comes out with the Beige Book. And real-world visitors explore a virtual world's conference in Los Angeles. Topics include how to use these virtual realities for movie making, toy design, and sales training. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In the course of throwing away a 250-point gain on the Dow this morning, traders took out a lot of their frustration on some big-name technology firms. Apple, Dell, and BlackBerry parent company Research in Motion all took it on the chin. You could have found that out for yourself, I suppose, by starting up your internet browser and doing a quick Google search. Microsoft's Internet Explorer, maybe, or Mozilla Firefox, or, as of today, Google's new browser, Chrome. Rafe Needleman's with CNET.com. He was at the Google announcement today, and Rafe, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
So why does Google need a browser anyway?
Well, Google says they need a browser to keep innovation alive and to light a fire under the guys at Microsoft and Mozilla who make Firefox and to push the state-of-the-art forward.
So what's the real reason, if that's what they say?
Well, you know, I think there's a shot across the bow with Microsoft. Google says they want to be respectful of all the things that you have out there already, like whatever search engine you use, even if it's not Google, whatever website you visit. But this is really a platform that Google can extend in the way they want to extend it to make applications richer. And richer applications are better for Google. The more people use web applications versus traditional applications, the better it is for Google.
Explain that. Can you give me an example of a web application that this browser is going to make richer?
Well, people are probably familiar with Google Maps, where, you know, you can drag the map around and zoom in and see satellite pictures and get traffic information. Those applications work pretty well right now on almost any modern browser. But with Google making the browser faster and more responsive and a little whizzier, and you can drag things around wherever you want, the applications can be more complex and even richer than they are right now. Google Documents is the other really big example of a rich application. This is their competitor to Microsoft's Office suite of Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Now, at the moment, Google Documents is nowhere near as powerful in raw functionality in terms of compared to Microsoft. But with a platform that is more robust, maybe the application can come up to speed and become a serious, credible threat to the traditional desktop application.
Isn't there an element of this, though, that's really all about searching and ads? If Google can get you using this browser, can't they then make Google the default search and then they get all that ad revenue from the search?
Well, what it all comes down to, if you do follow the money, it is that Google makes this money from advertising. There's no question about it. And a quick look at the terms of service on this new browser says they reserve the right to put ads in wherever they want. Now, I don't think they're going to do that, and I don't think Google is dumb enough to make the browsing experience so ad-laden and obnoxious that people don't want to use the browser. But ultimately, this is about advertising. This is about knowing what people are doing so you can serve them the ads that are most effective for them. And the more control you have over the platform, the more you know what people are doing.
How steep is the uphill fight for Google to get market share? I mean, Microsoft Internet Explorer has the lion's share. Firefox is coming up in second place. Where does Google Chrome fit in?
There is room. This is still, no matter what we think, this is still very early days on the Internet. Microsoft's market share, despite it being distributed, built in with every computer, every major Windows computer out there, it's still only, what, 76%, and Firefox is climbing? It will be a battle. But Google doesn't need this product to become the dominant browser for it to be effective. They don't need people to give up on Firefox for Google's Chrome mission to succeed, because if Chrome makes Firefox and Internet Explorer developers implement parts of the browser technology that are in Chrome, then Google wins, because the browser becomes a better platform for applications and for advertising, and Google wins even if people aren't using Google Chrome.
Rafe Needleman, he edits CNET.com's Webware. We got him on his cell phone, obviously, at the Google campus this afternoon up in Silicon Valley. Rafe, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Whoever wins in November is going to have to do some pretty serious thinking about health care. Surveys consistently show that to be right near the top of the list of things voters say they're worried about: the availability of care as well as the cost. On that latter point, one possible solution might be coming from an unlikely source, an alternative form of treatment that involves lying completely still while somebody sticks needles in you. Joel Rose reports now from Philadelphia.
Philadelphia Community Acupuncture occupies a big open room on the top floor of a former firehouse. About half a dozen patients doze in reclining chairs with little needles sticking out of their arms and legs.
Can I see your tongue? And you're sleeping better?
I'm going to bed early for me.
Ileana Pagan whispers with acupuncturist Corbin Perry. He takes her pulse, inspects her tongue, and then slides tiny needles a few millimeters into her skin, where they'll stay for most of the next hour.
How does this work again?
Acupuncture?
Yeah.
No one really knows. The most important thing is that we see results.
Ellen Vincent started the clinic with Corbin Perry just over a year ago. Now it's treating 150 patients a week for a variety of conditions.
A lot of back pain, a lot of anxiety, especially panic attacks. I have many people walking in the door in a state of panic, and we give them needles, and they walk out of the door saying, "Thank you so much, I feel so much better."
At a typical acupuncture clinic, Vincent and Perry would see one or two patients an hour and charge $80 or more a visit. But Philadelphia Community Acupuncture is organized around the so-called group visit model, where up to a dozen patients are seen at the same time. Because of the volume, they're able to keep their fees low. Their sliding scale starts at just $15 a treatment, which means more patients can afford to get treated more often.
When we say our goal is to take back acupuncture for the working class, we are not kidding.
Lisa Rohleder pioneered the community acupuncture business model at her clinic, Working Class Acupuncture, in Portland, Oregon.
A large number of our patients have no health insurance at all and no access to health care. We think that's wrong.
Rohleder says this model is closer to the way acupuncture is practiced in China, where it was first developed thousands of years ago. She thinks group visits for routine health care like this could be applied to more conventional medicine. Kirsten Geminer thinks so, too. She's a family doctor in Seattle who's been offering group visits for years for patients with diabetes and hypertension.
It's something that decreases cost, that's the grail in current medical care, with increased patient and provider satisfaction.
So far, there isn't a whole lot of research backing up Geminer's claims. Though one promising study in Denver did show that group visits for seniors lowered their overall health care costs by more than $40 per month. But not everyone is convinced that group visits are the holy grail. Deborah Peel heads the organization Patient Privacy Rights.
A significant number of people are not comfortable telling anyone but their doctor some of the things that are the most disturbing or troubling or frightening about their symptoms or their bodies. And so for actually getting the best treatment, one-on-one is far more effective than group treatment.
Even group visit advocates admit they won't work for everyone or every situation. But the idea does seem to be catching on with patients like Jessica Winiger at Philadelphia Community Acupuncture.
You feel like you're all sort of in this together, and I don't know. I mean, it sounds flaky to say, but there is some sort of like collective energy that's produced that I think is actually outweighs any of the negative aspects of not having a one-on-one, an extended one-on-one with a provider.
For Winiger, the most important thing is that her back finally stopped hurting. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which we learn airline food might not be such a bad thing after all. A couple of weeks ago, we told you how United planned to get rid of all the free food on some of its transatlantic flights. Nothing gratis, not even peanuts. Today, a rare aviation retreat in the world of cost-cutting. United says it heard from so many passengers about getting rid of the food that it has changed its mind. And on a related note, Southwest says keep your cash in your pockets, gang. Starting next week, it's credit cards only, please, for onboard purchases. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 26 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq lost 18 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 dipped 5 points. That is 0.4% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, students get hit by the housing slump.
Well, we're seeing Nevada, Michigan, Illinois, Florida as some of the states where schools are reporting sharper spikes in the increase in homelessness due to foreclosure.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.